Hello, I'm Hazm Seeker. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, a big U-turn on promised tax cuts for top earners in the UK. But is the British government's reversal enough to limit the financial damage? And has the Prime Minister lost her credibility? Also this week, Hurricane Ian joins a list of destructive and very costly storms. Is the world spending enough to mitigate or adapt to climate change? And Boeing's vice president tells us how the company's planes can reduce their carbon footprint. Well, just a few days ago, Britain's new prime minister was confident she would be able to kickstart economic growth by cutting taxes. Yet the country is still on course for a recession. Faced with market turmoil and criticism from within her own Conservative Party, Liz Truss was forced to scrap plans to remove the 45% top income tax rate on high earners. The U-turn is being seen as a humiliating about-face that leaves Truss's economic policy and premiership in crisis. Nadine Barber reports from London.
I have three priorities for our economy. Growth, growth, and growth.
The party conference had opened against a backdrop of intense market unease. Liz Truss's pro-growth tax-cutting mini-budget had led briefly to a slump in the value of the pound and instantly made thousands of mortgages more expensive, with expectations the Bank of England would have to raise interest rates faster. Then, at the 11th hour, Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng was told he'd have to reverse plans to scrap the 45% income tax rate for top earners.
I know the plan put forward only 10 days ago has caused a little turbulence. I get it.
That may well have been nervous laughter as the opposition Labour Party opened up a bigger lead in opinion polls.
Investors in the city are still waiting on crucial information, including the assessment already done by the Office for Budget Responsibility, the government's independent economic forecaster. And there's another group of people who might want their say on all of this over in Westminster.
It was only when the Prime Minister realised she was facing a mutiny from Conservative members of Parliament over the top tax rate that she ordered the U-turn.
Truss's position has always been that growth drives things so successfully that you don't need to explain how you fund your tax cuts, because a lower rate will give a higher yield with more growth. People aren't, broadly speaking, accepting that at the moment, and they're looking for an understanding on the government balance sheet as to where cuts are going to be made.
Of course, any cuts to public spending could prove hugely controversial. The government's refusal to commit to raising welfare payments in line with inflation has prompted open dissent from some cabinet members. One think tank says the mini-budget is regressive, as most of the gains go to richer households, and will struggle to achieve its stated aim.
The tax cuts that the government has proposed aren't looking like they're going to achieve the growth targets that the government is setting out for itself. It would have to increase growth by quite a substantial amount for them to even pay for themselves. And in terms of the spending cuts, that's automatically going to reduce GDP for the UK.
So it looks like the job of selling this new low-tax economic vision has really only just started. Nadine Barber for Counting the Cost, London.
Well, joining us now from London is Bilal Hafiz, Chief Executive of the Macro Hive. Thanks for being with us. So why was this so poorly received by the markets? And then the subsequent U-turn, is that going to be enough to calm the markets?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one big reason why the UK mini budget was so poorly received was, number one, the size of the deficit is fairly large. So tax cuts. And then before that, there was the energy subsidy with the introduction of price caps in the UK. So the amount of borrowing the UK government is having to do is very large compared to what it had announced in the previous administration. So one was the scale of the deficit, but also it was the way the UK was going to fund that deficit, which was to issue bonds, but particularly issue bonds at the shorter tenor of the curve. So 1-2 year parts of the curve, which weren't particularly liquid. And so there seemed to be a lack of coordination with the Debt Management Office in terms of the way the government would issue bonds. And that really set a bad tone for the interest rate markets in the UK, which over the past week or so have experienced significant volatility. Then on the U-turn, to some extent, it does potentially help the administration insofar as it removes one of the politically toxic parts of the mini budget. But at the same time, it is a U-turn. And so other parts of the Conservative Party can smell blood. And so they may challenge other parts of Liz Truss's program, which could introduce much more uncertainty about what the government can actually do going forward.
And will people on the lowest income still pick up the bulk of the costs of the cuts? And what about middle class families? Everything from mortgage to food is getting more expensive now in the UK.
Absolutely. So on balance, the measures are regressive, which means that people at the lower end will get the least amount of benefit, will suffer more than people who have more income. And that applies to lower economic classes as well as the middle class as well. And as you rightly point out, the thing that would really hit people hard is the increase in interest rates. So people's mortgages, when they reset their mortgages, most people in the UK have two-year fixed mortgage rates, and many of them will start to reset over the next 6 to 12 months, they'll be in for a shock. Their monthly payments could double or triple even in many, many cases. So this is really quite a big shock to the system, especially people's expenses.
And the Bank of England is not going to keep intervening for too much longer. They are expected to raise interest rates. But what does all of this mean going forward then?
Yeah, the Bank of England's in a tough situation because on the one hand, they had committed to stop buying government bonds. But obviously, last week, they had to buy government bonds to stabilise the UK interest rate markets. So that's one challenge they face because they're having to do things that contradict an earlier policy of theirs. At the same time, as you rightly point out, they have committed to raising interest rates to reduce inflation. Now, the issue here is that the markets are expecting them to raise interest rates very significantly, up to maybe 5% or even 5.5% by next year. That's more than the Bank of England said that they are willing to increase interest rates by, but inflation is very high in the UK. Now, of course, because the UK has this energy price cap, that means inflation could come down a bit. But on balance, Bank of England is in the tough situation of having to raise rates at a time where people's household bills are going up.
And these plans by the British government have been dubbed Trussonomics, and it's modelled on Reaganomics, which is, of course, a reference to the US president's tax cuts in the 1980s, the idea being that these tax cuts would create more wealth in the economy and thereby lead to higher tax revenues. Does that work? I mean, has it ever really worked?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a big debate around all of this. I mean, in general, it seems like the effects are much weaker than people think. So the so-called trickle-down economics, the historic evidence is quite weak that it does work. What does tend to work more are so-called supply-side reforms. And this is something that's part of Truss economics, which is to reduce regulation, to reduce red tape, make it easier for business to operate in the UK. So that is something that Liz Truss's administration is engaging in, and that potentially could be positive in the long run. So there is a silver lining in all of this. The question is whether she has the will and the buy-in from her party to be able to push through those reforms in the coming few years.
So, I mean, I know you mentioned the sort of political implications of this. Has the Prime Minister lost her credibility, you think? What does this mean for the long term and for the Conservative Party?
I think there's been a big loss of credibility. One basic example is the fact that many of these announcements were not discussed with the rest of the cabinet. So the rest of the cabinet are starting to speak against Liz Truss in public, which is a very bad sign. Public polling shows that Liz Truss is the least popular Tory leader in modern times. So she's lost a lot of credibility with the public, but also within her party. So there's already talk that there could be another leadership challenge, which introduces additional uncertainty. So the next month or so is going to be critical for Liz Truss to try to get over this negativity and try to stabilize her position. So it's a very precarious situation that she's in right now. And the next 4 or 5 weeks are going to be critical to see whether she'll be able to regain her credibility and push through her program.
Bilal Hafiz in London, thanks for being with us.
Great, thank you.
the United States has gone through 332 climate-related disasters in the past 40 years that have cost at least $1 billion. And they're happening more often now. Hurricane Ian is the latest, and it's estimated that could cost up to $100 billion in damage and economic losses. That makes it one of the costliest storms in U.S. history. President Joe Biden's recent climate law is providing only $37 billion a year over a decade. Kristen Salumi reports from New York.
Tallying up the losses from Hurricane Ian has only just begun.
Our roof is in the back of the house.
For these retirees, seeing the damage to their homes and neighborhood was overwhelming.
There's no words for it. It's like, holy cow, what a mess.
The southwest coast of Florida took the brunt of wind and storm surge. But the impact of the heavy rainfall was felt further inland and up the United States' eastern coast. Experts say wetter storms is one impact of climate change.
The majority of the cost, as well as the lives lost as a result of hurricanes and tropical cyclones, comes from flooding. It comes from storm surge. It comes from the rainfall.
One of the costliest storms in U.S. history, Superstorm Sandy, wasn't even a hurricane by the time it got here in New York. And yet here's where it did the most damage. $82 billion in flooding and infrastructure costs. Some early estimates for Hurricane Ian are approaching that.
More than 40,000 utility workers were dispatched to Florida alone to help restore power. Water mains and roads have also suffered extensive damage, not to mention bridges. The governor said 800 of them were in need of assessment. President Biden declared a disaster in Florida, paving the way for federal assistance for infrastructure as well as individuals.
It means the federal government will provide individual assistance of $37,900 for home repairs, another $37,900 for lost property, for everything from automobile to a lost wedding ring.
With several healthcare facilities damaged and forced to evacuate, health impacts and related costs will take years to fully understand.
And it's gone in a flash.
While the human costs remain incalculable. Kristen Salumi for Counting the Cost, New York.
Hurricane Ian also knocked out power across all of Cuba and devastated some of the country's most important tobacco farms. Several other nations experienced extreme weather conditions last month, including Pakistan, where the worst floods in the country's history left a third of its people underwater. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused the world's 20 richest countries of not doing enough to stop the planet from overheating. And developing countries are calling on rich nations to pay the losses that climate change has inflicted on the world's poorest people. Well, joining us now from Munich is Dr. Miranda Schreuers, Chair of Environmental and Climate Policy at the Technical University of Munich. Thanks for being with us, Doctor. Let me ask you first off, the damage for this is estimated to cost up to $100 billion. How is that going to be paid for? Who's going to pay for it?
It's an extremely expensive storm that is going to cost the insurance companies as well as private individuals and eventually also the state huge amounts of money. It's something that all of us will have to chip into. All of these kinds of big storms are storms that need to be paid for by multiple individuals. But the reality is there's money, that's money that many people don't have.
And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that Hurricane Ian shows that no economy in the world is immune from the climate crisis. Is this $370 billion that the government there is providing under this new climate law, is that going to be enough to tackle the problem?
Oh, you know, there's so much work that needs to be done with building infrastructure in North America, the United States in particular, which just hasn't invested enough, whether it's in the electric grid system and bridges and roads. And then in new technologies like the renewable energy field or electric automobiles, that alone is going to require most of that money. And when we look at climate adaptation, the reality that we have rising sea levels, that we have storms that are expected to increase in intensity. So what we saw here with Ian is likely to become something that's much more regular, much more often, really damaging storms. There's going to be a lot more money that needs to be invested into rethinking how we build, where we build, and bringing nature back in order to protect coastlines better. In the past, we've been building, and I say we, I mean all around the world, we've been building right along the coast. We've been building in areas where it requires deforestation, taking away the mangrove forests in Southeast Asia or in the Florida Keys, where you see people building on sandbanks. It's really something that needs to be reconsidered, because climate change is going to mean we're going to have higher seas, we're going to have more storm surges, we're going to have more intense rainfalls, and this is unfortunately only the beginning of a really serious problem.
Yeah, let's talk about the energy crisis, the current energy crisis right now, which is affecting much of the world, and how that's hampering efforts to combat. Is that hampering efforts to combat global climate change, or would it perhaps accelerate the transition to renewable energy?
Yes, we really need to wake up and start thinking about how we can wean ourselves away and rapidly from fossil fuels and build out alternatives. Energy efficiency is still a real potential. There's still a lot of energy saving potential, which is the cheapest way to deal with a crisis. But then also to invest in renewable energies, which are much cheaper than they used to be. You can put photovoltaics onto school buildings, onto rooftops, offshore wind, which provides a fairly steady kind of wind. We're seeing big improvements with heat pumps and the potential to heat and cool with using kind of a geothermal energy system. So there's a lot of potentials here, and we're seeing booming trends in the industry, but there's a long ways to go.
And Egypt is pushing for loss and damage compensation at the top of the UN climate summit agenda. It is hosting the next climate summit. Do you expect any progress there? And will countries ever live up to this $100 billion pledge on adaptation and mitigation?
Well, certainly the developing countries that have contributed least to the climate change problem are the ones that are going to most seriously feel the brunt of these extreme storms, you know, whether it's the floods or the droughts or extreme temperatures. These are the areas that are also least able to cope with these extremes. And so I think there is something to this question of compensation, dealing with the damages that they are facing. Denmark has actually signed up as the first country to pay for some of this damage. So it's setting a new marker for the rest of the world. But we have seen real problems getting countries to actually pay up. The commitments have been made politically on paper, but in reality, the funds are only flowing in part. And I think this is an area where we need to rethink also how we cooperate with the developing world. We need to bring in insights from not only the North, but also from the South, and thinking about what are the right approaches to adaptation. How can we make sure that food security is still there for areas that are being hit by drought or salinization of soils? We need to think about how we build differently in developing countries to deal with monsoon rains that are going to become more extreme. So there's a lot of work to be done, but also a lot of potential. But it's true, the question of who's going to pay for this is very big on the agenda. And unfortunately, that's going to be a very difficult challenge to get through right now, because we're all suffering from the energy prices, OPEC oil embargo right now, obviously the Russian war in the Ukraine. It's doing crazy things to energy prices around the world. And in this kind of political context, I fear it's going to be a challenging uphill battle in the next COP in Egypt.
Dr. Miranda Schreuers in Munich, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Now, commercial air travel is making a comeback from the pandemic after months during which it was virtually grounded. That's led to an increase in demand for new planes to steer the industry's recovery. Airplane deliveries and commercial services could be worth more than $10 trillion over the next 20 years. But manufacturers are also under pressure to cut their carbon emissions to save the planet. Al Jazeera's Osama bin Javed spoke with Michael Arthur, the vice president of American plane maker Boeing. He started by asking about the industry's outlook.
Well, the aviation industry's had a really tough 3 years because of COVID, but is coming out globally much faster than people expected. Now, it's starting with local flights and national flights and regional flights, but even international flights are picking up really very fast. And this part of the world has actually come back faster than many other parts of the world in terms of being back to 2019 capacity. So it's quite exciting how that industry has picked up. You ask about the long term, Osama. We make a 20-year forward projection, and we're pretty much sticking to where it was before COVID. So we're talking about the world's fleet doubling, about 40,000, 41,000 new aeroplanes being bought over that 20-year period. I mean, this industry has a huge future, and the whole of your region is part of that future because it's a key part of the world for aviation. The Russian fleet has been quite big in the past, but if you look forward over that 20-year period, actually only 1,000 planes, just over 1,000 planes, were in the forward look for Russia itself. I mean, as soon as the war started, we cut out everything we do in Russia. We had quite a big operation in Russia, and there is nothing there now. We've even chosen to stop taking titanium from Russia. Not everybody has done that, but Boeing decided for good reason that we would not do that.
One of the major concerns about sustainability and sustainable fuel is that it isn't the silver bullet that people would like it to see it. There is an issue with transporting it. There are that many people who are producing it. Even when it is being produced, the price is quite high. So the 2050 carbon neutrality target, is it achievable? Is it real? And how is Boeing going to help?
There are four big elements to this. First, the best thing you can do is buy a new plane, from whichever company. I mean, 25% carbon reduction on a plane that replaces an old plane. The second thing that we're working on is digital technology to help fly more efficiently and avoid circling around airports and so on. You can save about 10% that way. The third, and this is the big new area for us, is to get those fleets flying with sustainable aviation fuel. And then beyond that, beyond 2050, we're looking at new technologies, electric planes. Where does hydrogen fit into this? But that won't change the fleet that's coming now. It's sustainable aviation fuel which will help do that. And particularly for a place like Qatar, because here you have very long-haul passengers, and 80% of CO2 output comes from the long-haul flights. And we do it ourselves all the time, and you can do it 100% in a demonstration one. But in practice, it's not very economic because the price is several times higher than conventional fuel. So how do we get that change? And it's partly scale of production. And you're right, it has to be all around the world. I mean, not in every country, but in most regions. And each region will have its own way of producing SAF. The technology is there. It's a question of getting scale at a price that works for the industry. And we're working that.
Let's talk about Boeing. Going forward, how is Boeing going to sustain its growth? Is it going to come from technology? Is it going to come from the aviation sector in the commercial part? Or is it going to be the military hardware and solutions that Boeing provides?
I think it's all three of those. I mean, we roughly 60-40 is the commercial to the defense side of our business, but build into that a big and growing sector called services. So on both the commercial and defense side, we're helping sustain airplanes through the life of the customer running the planes. So that's all a big, big growth area. I mean, my job is to see how we can become even more global as a company. We are already totally global, but I see big growth, for example, in the commercial field in Asia. Middle East and Asia are going to be big markets over the next 20 years. And all of that is growth. We're very excited about it as we come out of probably the three hardest years in aviation's history in terms of commercial flight because of COVID.
And that is our show for this week. Remember, you can get in touch with us by tweeting me at Hazem Seeker, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Hazem Seeker. From the whole team here, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.